Filicide is the deliberate act of a parent killing their own child and has taken place since the dawn of time. Reasons for such an act have barely changed over millennia, although drugs and or alcohol are often prevalent in modern cases. To commit such an act is unthinkable for most people, but to compound the horror, this parent is in fact a serial killer. Sometimes the village is deserted. This is the case of Benita Jacks, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I am Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
Big thanks to Claire G for joining the Patreon, and Sue for upping your support. We appreciate it, thank you. Mother, that's your cue. What did you... I don't know what to say. I don't have anything written down. You're the one with the script.
Thank you, everyone. We really do appreciate you all. This case is disturbing, as our opener indicates. And if you find the subject matter distressing, we understand and hope you will join us on another episode. I tried. I really did. But I cannot find a trial transcript, nor any appeals. So I am really going from news reports and one particular YouTube video I watched called Cop Stories, episode 6, which I will link. This was with Mitch McCreadle, the lead homicide detective on the case. There are other podcasts, but you know I don't listen to them because plagiarism. I also can't find any documentaries, although there are other YouTubes out there. Even the police interviews seem to have vanished, although there is some in the video I watched, and it's very enlightening. We are off to Washington, D.C. via Maryland. Let us start as far back as I can get. Benita Jacks. I don't know her exact date of birth. 1974 is my best estimate. Lived in Maryland with her mother. No idea on father or siblings. Benita claims to have left school in sixth grade. I'm old. I don't understand the USA grades. 11 to 12 years old, apparently. Yet, her mother says, absolutely not. She was grade 10. So 16 when she falls pregnant and gives birth to Brittany Marie Jacks on the 5th of January 1991. Brittany's father. Well, Benita wasn't 100% sure, or maybe just hoped. She did try and file for child support against a man who denied paternity, and tests were ordered. Things go backwards and forwards for a while in court. He is denying, she's saying it's him. Then on the 6th of October 1996, Benita gives birth to another daughter, Tatiana. Tatiana's father admitted he was the father. We do not know if there was any sort of financial support. Benita, by this point, was working as a hairdresser, and her two girls are living with her mother. Maybe she was just too busy working and being a mum because she failed to turn up for one court hearing in regard to Brittany. I have no idea if it is true, but the rumours are that Benita hadn't given her DNA, or maybe Brittany's DNA, because the man she was saying was the child's father had provided his, and the court couldn't just rule that he was the dad without proof, and Benita wasn't providing it.
Courts can say you're the father, even without proof. If you've assumed the parental role and been paying for a period of time, because if you believe the kid was yours and you pay for it or whatever, have they ever lived together?
No. He's denied it all since day one. There are certain places in the States where if you were married at the time, even if the paternity tests prove that you're not the father, you're still legally the father.
It's in the favour of the children, not the parents, because there is a child that needs looking after, so someone has to pay for it.
Yeah.
That's the argument, I guess.
Well, Benita apparently had to spend 2 days in jail for that. Seems a bit extreme, but maybe not, because when she eventually did provide the DNA, he wasn't the daddy. By 2000, Benita was doing okay, though. She was going to college and getting herself qualified as a cosmetologist, or beautician, as we would say, and was making a good life for her and her girls, who were 9 and 4 at the time. Benita meets Nathaniel Fogel Jr., who was 4 or 5 years older. Know absolutely nothing about him. Benita's college would do discounted treatments for people who would allow students to practice on them. We have exactly the same. Even dental hospitals do it. Everything is closely supervised, but things take four times as long, but probably cost less than a third of the price at a full salon. Apparently, they met when she did his hair. They start dating and move in together very, very quickly. And daughter number three arrives in 2001, Nakaya, with daughter number four, Asia, arriving a year later. Yet Benita is still going to college when she can and eventually gets the much-wanted license in 2005. And surprisingly, that's when Benita's life starts its downward spiral. I don't know the living situation, if Nathaniel worked or not, but they become homeless and Benita and the girls move back in with her mother. Benita's mother refuses to have Nathaniel in the house, and so Benita moves back out with Nathaniel and the girls, and they spend time sofa surfing.
Do we know why the mother won't let Nathaniel?
I have suspicions, and I'll get into it later. Strange stories come out from that time of Benita and Nathaniel allowing the younger two children to smoke marijuana. I have read where people who know her say she absolutely would not have allowed that, and yet others who also knew her say, yes, she absolutely did do it.
The two oldest were allowed to smoke?
Two youngest. They were toddlers.
What, Asia and Nakaya?
Yes. Yeah.
They I didn't say anything there because I was kind of confused. I know whiskey on the gums to shut a kid up, but not let them smoke weed.
No, I know. Well, they must wear out their welcome, as in December 2005, they apply for housing assistance and appear to spend 4 months at what's called a hypothermia homeless shelter. Presumably, that's only available in the winter months. This one is in Washington, D.C. It's probably only about 30 minutes from where they used to live in Maryland, so not quite as big a move as I envisaged. I'm going to go off on a slight tangent for any listeners that are not British. The most southern point in England is Land's End in Cornwall. If you drive from there to the tip of Scotland to John O'Groats, the distance by road is 874 miles or 1,407 kilometres. And with our rotten roads would take you about 14 hours and 30 minutes, assuming no traffic jams or accidents. As the crow flies, the distance from Land End to John O'Groats is 603 miles, which is 970 kilometres. This is why, when we talk about cases where they have moved 3,000 miles within the same country, across time zones, it's a bit mind-blowing.
I have driven to Cornwall, took about 7 hours, and I couldn't feel my ass for like a day and a half. My ass was just dead.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to stop every hour and a half at some sort of service station because it's too long a drive. We ain't built for it over here.
We just don't do it. Back to the case. While in DC, Benita and Nathaniel apply for food stamps, Medicaid, and something called TANF, T-A-N-F, which stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which is a bloody horrible name for a federal assistance grant, which involves a 5-year lifetime limit and requires that all recipients of welfare aid must find work within 3 years of receiving aid, including single parents who are required to work at least 30 hours per week or 35 for two-parent families.
Is it the needy word?
Yes. That bugged me. Can we also talk about this lifetime limit? I mean, come on. People lose jobs through no fault of their own, get sick, and it's a one-off deal. You can't reapply again for help from this program? I get the 5 years bit. That's more than enough time to get back on your feet. But that seems really... I can't even think of the word. I hope there are other things to fill in the gaps if the unthinkable happens. But this, again, goes to show the level of bureaucracy around any help for people that need it, and it gets worse. So they were on track, maybe, to sort themselves out. January, Brittany enrolls in high school. Tatiana enrolls in elementary school. April 2006, they leave the shelter and supposedly move in with friends, or it's possible it was actually Nathaniel's mum who rented a place for them and hoped they would sort themselves out. June 2006, Benita has what's called a behavioural mental health appointment via Medicaid. At what point Nathaniel gets sick, I'm not sure, but it may explain the application for Medicaid. But he ends up in hospital. He's diagnosed with leukaemia. It's a cancer that can come out of nowhere and can kill very, very quickly. Or you can survive for years with treatment. What type he has isn't good, but he leaves the hospital against medical advice. And he and Benita and the children end up living in a van by July of 2006. It's probably true, I think, that Nathaniel's mum only got them the place and they got evicted after 3 months and then end up in this van.
By the sounds of it, the funds seemingly rely on Nathaniel. Is Benita working in this period? She's got qualifications in the beauty industry, so...
Yeah, I don't know whether she's working cash in hand, whether she's working at all, but they've applied for all this government assistance.
I was going to say she was doing better when it was just Brittany and Tatiana, but now there's 4 kids.
Yeah.
The demand's kind of more, and there's also now a man at the house, so there's weird costs.
And he's sick now, so yeah. He probably can't work even if he was before. So they're living in this van. Because authorities can't track where they live... Presumably the children have been pulled from school as well, is that they're off everyone's radar. How this happened, I don't know. But Benita is given a fresh start in Washington, D.C. by a charity who give her a house for her and the girls to rent. She should have been in a good position to start again. But she isn't. I have also read in strange places that not only did the marijuana use continue and escalate, she may well have gotten addicted to PCP at the same time. PCP, angel dust, more commonly known to my age anyway. More your chemical wheelhouse than mine, Cameron, but according to my searches, I'm not even going to try and pronounce this damn stuff, it is a dissociative anaesthetic, mainly used recreationally for its significant mind-altering effects. PCP may cause hallucinations, distorted perceptions of sound, and violent behaviour. As a recreational drug, it's typically smoked, but it can be taken by mouth, snorted, or injected. You usually sprinkle it on either a cigarette or on the marijuana. The adverse effects may include seizures, coma, addiction, an increased risk of suicide, and there's the whole range of them. PCP works primarily as an NMDA receptor antagonist. You'll know what that means, Cameron.
Is that pause expecting me to explain it?
Yes.
Usually when you have receptors, you've got agonism and antagonism. One of them is it essentially blocks the receptor, and the other one is it binds the receptor and tells it to do something. That's usually what it does. So you said it's an antagonist.
Yes.
So that means it antagonizes the cell or the receptor, which prevents it from doing something. So, for example, something like Narcan, that binds to the opioid receptor and prevents the opioid from doing stuff. As far as I understand, that's a very layman explanation, I think.
Yet, by August of 2006, Brittany is enrolled in Booker T. Washington School in Washington. That name made me laugh. You wouldn't know it unless you're ancient like me. It's what's called a charter school. We in the UK would call them academies. It's the same principle. They are government or state funded, but don't sit under the same rules as local school districts. Americans seem to love them, but I know in the UK there are problems with some. They're run as businesses. It's all about profit. Yet some really do good. Others do not and have their licenses pulled. Anyway, Brittany is in one and seemingly loving it. And Tatiana and Asia also enroll in one in the September. And they also have a well child visit under this Medicaid program. And Nakia starts school as well. On the up. Then life takes another dive. The food stamp program wants people to send documents every 6 months to prove entitlement. Seems reasonable enough, doesn't it? Benefits are unnecessarily complex systems, and it possibly overwhelmed Benita as she didn't refile and the stamps stopped. I believe she never refiled, said the paperwork was too much. I know it's not a lot of help money-wise and it's embarrassing to use these stamps or a card, I think it is now, but it's still better than nothing. So how they were supporting themselves, I have no idea. December 2006, Medicaid health plan people contact Benita. They want to see her as they think she needs continuing treatment. It's on record both she and Nathaniel have substance abuse problems, which usually can cause other health problems. Nathaniel already has leukemia, but neither of them want to engage. January 2007. Benita is arrested in Maryland for driving an unregistered vehicle and a few other motoring charges. Usually a slap on the wrist, but fines. And I'm wondering how she was going to pay it. I believe it was Benita's car, but how she could afford it, I've no idea. It may explain why she was in Maryland, because in February of 2007, Nathaniel dies there in a hospice, aged 37. Benita is devastated. She doesn't go to the funeral and doesn't tell the children he's dead. I'm still baffled why he was in Maryland, and yet they had this house in Washington. Maybe my timeline is wrong. It's bloody hard to figure this out. And the house was just for her and the girls? I think it's only a two-bedroom too. Benita and Brittany are not getting along. There are stories of loud arguments that neighbours can hear through the walls between the two. Could be a mother-daughter thing and teenagers. It happens. Or maybe it was actually worse than that. 3rd of March was the last day anyone saw Brittany at school. Even her boyfriend couldn't get in contact with her. They used MySpace. 21st of March, almost 3 weeks later, all the other children are unenrolled from school. 27th of April, Brittany's school had a social worker who was assigned to her. That social worker got in contact with the Child and Family Services via a hotline to report that Brittany hadn't attended school. Social workers from the school try and go to the house to see Brittany, and Benita won't let them in. The day after, a social worker from Child and Family Services goes to the house. They couldn't get an answer at the door and left a note or a letter for Benita to contact them. 30th of April, the school social worker again goes to the house and speaks with Benita, who won't let the woman in. The social worker calls the police to come to the home and alerts Child and Family Social Workers, and they reported that the mother appeared to have mental health issues and was possibly holding Brittany hostage by refusing to allow her to attend school. This is where it all breaks apart, according to the court case. The following is from a review into what happened. Police visit the home and report to the CFSA social worker. The officer said that he visited the home and saw the children at home, and the children appeared to be well and healthy. When the police officer inquired why the children were not in school, Benita informed him that the children were being homeschooled, and she told the officer that without a warrant, the Metro Police Department couldn't enter the home. What actually happened was the officer said he saw the three youngest, but not Brittany. Guess what? He lied. He didn't see any of them. He retracted his statement on the stand. Genuinely have no idea what happened to him. Should have been fired, obviously, and probably prosecuted. Dereliction of duty or something. Anyway, back to the timeline. From the 1st of May, social services and the CFS try and contact Benita. She is not opening the door. For all intents and purposes, from what they can see at the house, it's been abandoned. There is no sign of any furniture through the windows, and there is posts and flyers piled up inside the metal gate security thing on the front door. 16th of May, a CFS worker thinks they've found an address in Maryland that the family may be living at. It's 2007. No email. A bloody letter is sent to the local services. They do make a phone call, though. They actually closed the case on the basis that they'd moved to Maryland when they hadn't had it confirmed that they were there. They close the case. They actually close the case. I know they are overworked and now, but honestly, I even wondered if it was a Friday and somebody just had enough, but apparently the 16th of May 2007 was a Wednesday. There must have been processes and procedures to follow, but maybe someone's supervisor was lax too. It does all come out later. 13th of June. Brittany was unenrolled from the school. That puzzled me, but it's entirely possible the school took her off its list of students as she'd stopped attending, and it wasn't Benita doing it. It's not clear from the report. 14th of June, the CFS people get a letter from Maryland. No sign of the family. What should have happened was the file being reopened, but of course it wasn't. Nothing happens officially. And the automated services roll on. 31st of October, that horrible TANF thing is cancelled as Benita hadn't filled in the forms to reconfirm that status. Yet in January of 2008, they are enrolled in the Medicaid. I think the report may be wrong, as there is mention of the plan is able to be extended by 4 months if they don't recertify. January the 9th, 2008. Benita has lost all benefits. The rent is not being paid. The landlord wants the property back, so an eviction was scheduled with the US Marshal Service turning up to make sure it went ahead as planned. I was, what the hell are the US Marshals doing that for? I thought they were the ones running about grabbing bad guys, not evicting people. But according to the website, DC is one of the few places that has to use them. There's a massive amount of rules behind these evictions, various notices and 75-day rulings, and I think Benita must have known for months that this was coming. I will summarise what the lead homicide detective said happened next. And yes, I have seen the photographs. Police get a call. Marshals had attempted to evict Benita, and the smell alone had alerted them something was wrong. Marshals get into the house. Benita has to let them in. They walk into the living room. Nothing. It's bare. The kitchen is just a pile of rubbish, literal rubbish, everywhere. There is no running water and no electricity. They then try and go upstairs, and Benita tries to stop them. She is moved aside and they follow their noses. At the top of the stairs are two doors, one directly opposite the stairs, and next to that door is another one on the right, which had been sealed around the frame with duct tape. Marshals open the first door and find the room is completely bare of furniture as well. But laying on the floor close to the right-hand wall is the body of Asia, face down. Next to her is the body of Nakaya, also face down. And finally, the body of Tatiana, face down as well. Tatiana is the last one. They are positioned oldest to youngest towards the wall. There is no chance that this is recent. Decomposition has been set in for a very long time. They move to the second door with the tape and gain access. They find another bare room, with a body so decomposed it was impossible to identify at that time, but was later confirmed as Brittany. She was almost mummified. I will talk about that more in the case autopsy. Police are called and they take Benita in for questioning. They take her clothing, obviously, and give her one of those white jumpsuit things. There is very limited availability of that interrogation. It took 6 hours, apparently. Benita is very softly spoken. They start to ask her questions about what happened. She says, basically, the girls just laid down and died a couple of days ago. Benita said it was time to sleep. They laid down and Asia didn't wake up the next morning. The next night, the other two laid down and the next morning, Nakaya didn't wake up. And then 2 nights later, Tatiana lays down and didn't wake up. Benita swaps between how many nights they went to sleep and didn't wake up. One time it was one night, one time it was 2 nights. She says it 3 different ways. I'm not sure the detectives followed it any better than I did. There is no mention of going to bed. There is no furniture, no beds, no blankets, nothing. And these children just lay down beside the body of a sibling and didn't wake up. Detectives know none of this is true. It's very obvious whatever happened didn't happen just a few days ago. Bonita is asked why she didn't get help. It's a mess. Says something along the lines of, I knew it would be my fault. None of it makes sense. Yet the detectives try and get her to give answers because they were worried what her defence was going to be, as obviously this was a major murder case and they were hyper aware of any claims around mental illness, either then or in the future. She gives them nothing, but she leaves them with the impression she was fully aware of what she was saying. She didn't try and make any outlandish claims, but also had an answer for every question. The answers may not have made much logical sense to most people, but they were left in no doubt she knew what was happening around her. This is the 9th of January. Everyone is scrambling. The mayor issues a statement on the 11th that they will be investigating all agencies that had any contact with the family. It goes very quiet. There were the usual court hearings. The judge wanted her to have a mental health assessment. She refused to cooperate three times. Her reasoning? She'd already told the police and a psychologist what had happened once when she was arrested, and that was enough. Basically, she didn't want to talk about it anymore. The judge has her sent to a mental health facility, and she's actually found to have some sort of psychiatric disorder. I was very interested to find she was put on Haldol. That's a brand name for haloperidol. It's an antipsychotic drug used in the treatment of schizophrenia, tics in Tourette's, mania in bipolar, delirium, agitation, acute psychosis, and hallucinations from alcohol withdrawal. I did wonder if it was used for cannabis psychosis, but I can't find anything specific to that. And I also know that my father was put on that. We don't know whether he had dementia or what, but when he wrecked the hospital ward at 2 a.m, they put him on haloperidol, and it was the only thing that they could do to calm him down. Why was she sent to the facility? Well, maybe claims that she made later in interview and not in the original interrogation. It's maybe why the limited press took an interest in this case. Apparently, the children were possessed by demons, and if they died, they would be resurrected. They were screaming and acting up. They were just too much. Too much. What too much? Who knows? Only Bonita. Brittany, however, was different. She was possessed by a demon called Jezebel, who was, in Bonita's own words, a prostitute and was able to cause suffering and spread disease. Where the heck did all this sudden demon stuff come from? And it seemed like the original homicide detective was taken aback by that as well, as he'd never heard her mention any of it when he interrogated her. She had met with an imam in the prison. Oh, there you go. Demons. Yet, she also tells detectives that at one point she had learned about demons from Nathaniel and had studied the Bible with him. And oh, by the way, he wasn't dead. That explains why she didn't go to his funeral nor tell the children. He isn't dead. When he's due to come back, she didn't say. That Haldol seemed to have worked though. Bonita had two forced injections. And it was only then that she started talking.
Wait, is he dead?
Oh, yeah, he's dead.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it was some kind of ruse, but he isn't actually dead, as she said. Oh, he isn't dead. I didn't know. I wasn't actually sure what was her making up mental bullshit or real. Okay.
Nope.
Because we've had it before where I've not suspected people are actually dead, but that's usually because there's money involved. He might just be dead.
No, I've seen his gravestone.
Okay, he's dead.
Yeah. She wanted off the meds, and she got away. Bonita is now saying that the girls died before her electricity was turned off, and that happened in September of 2007, so at least 4 months before they were found, which tied in with what the ME thought and not just a few days before the eviction. September 2008, Bonita is indicted with premeditated first-degree murder and failure to provide adequate nutrition and medical attention. January 2009. Benita is able to assist in her defence, but only in as much as that she was found competent to stand trial. Yet her lawyers wanted her to plead insanity. She refused, wouldn't even allow assessment. The judge eventually ruled she was fit to stand trial after Benita refused the offering of a jury trial. That surprised a lot of watchers. She may have had a better chance against a jury, but allowing one person to decide her fate was unusual. I did wonder if it was tied up with her delusions, seeing the judge as some sort of mythical figure. I may be making leaps here. The hospital said she was off her medication now, but they wanted to keep her until trial to make sure she was stable. So, stable and not insane, yet they wanted to keep her. Benita also wanted to plead not guilty, fire her lawyers and represent herself, which the judge hoped she wouldn't. She just smiled at him. July 2009, the trial starts with Benita facing 12 felony charges with three lawyers at her side. They tried. They really did try. They tried challenging the pathologist on his report. The three younger girls were believed to have been strangled, but due to the decomposition, it was hard to tell exactly. The defence tried to say it was their T-shirts that had left the strangulation marks on their neck as they had decomposed. The pathologist said that Brittany had been stabbed multiple times in the abdomen, but had the same problem as with the younger girls, decomposition. The defence tried to cast doubt, as in she could have committed suicide, or perhaps the wounds were just decomposition.
Brittany was stabbed in the abdomen,
yeah,
several times. Do you think that goes along with the Jezebel, Whore of Babylon type,
yeah,
imagery she's, yeah, trying to project?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
The reason why I ask is that's where like the womb, uterus is, or that kind of,
yep,
feminine stuff. So I'm assuming that's where that's why she was stabbed there specifically, because it's tied to that.
I agree with you. The defence also tried to get a crime scene technician to say that the bodies were underneath a skylight and sunlight had sped up the decomposition. So them being killed later made it better somehow? None of that flew. Benita didn't take the stand in her own defence, only sensible decision she'd made for years. Benita's mother took the stand, called as a witness for the prosecution. She had only good things to say about Benita. She said she took good care of her children. She never saw her mistreat them, and she thought it would have been out of character for Benita to harm them. But she admitted that she hadn't seen Benita since 2005 and that she'd called social services in 2006 to check up on them. But if Benita had contacted her, she would have helped her. Nathaniel's mum also took the stand, said that Benita had forbidden her to see the girls and that Benita had said, "I will kill you," if she went anywhere near them. Lots of people testified, neighbours, social workers and friends. They described how the girls had looked well presented and turned out, but then suddenly looked unkempt and thin. The arguments between Brittany and Benita, etc. The police officer that supposedly saw the younger girls suddenly admitted he may have gotten it wrong. They think the girls died in the summer. The trial took 9 days and she was predictably found guilty, and sentencing was due to happen on the 16th of October 2009. But the defence tried again. They filed motions to ask that an independent counsel investigate Benita's refusal to use the insanity defence. There was no death penalty, so why they were so hung up on that is strange. I guess at least you can say they really did try hard for a defendant who didn't want them to. She could hardly ever claim ineffective counsel. 18th of December 2009, the judge dismissed that request for what amounted to an investigation, and she's finally sentenced to 120 years in jail. 30 years for each murder, and all of it consecutive, not concurrent, which is what the defence asked for. She was 35. The defence immediately said that they would file an appeal. I cannot find one anywhere. The judge made a point to say that there were no victim impact statements on behalf of those children that may have allowed the court to know the children better. Read into that what you will. The thing that comes across is that Benita never tried to get help after Nathaniel died. She didn't help herself. The defence tried to make out that she was consumed with grief. And if that's true, there was still help available. Many agencies can step in. But if she was so far gone, then the ones who should have stepped in didn't. All except that school social worker who was screaming into the void. The aftermath was that investigation I spoke about. The amount of people that should have done something that didn't. The mayor fired six, including a supervisor. Yet after an appeal, three of them got their jobs back. There was also a law change. Up until this case, children being homeschooled in DC sort of fell between the gaps, and that was tightened up so they couldn't just vanish. There are a huge number of similarities for me for our Patreon episode on Michelle Blair, the one who put her children in the freezer and only got found out when she was evicted. Benita wasn't angry, unlike Michelle, but the level of cruelty was similar. The prosecution think that Benita somehow thought she would have a year before she would get evicted, and somehow those bodies would decompose or just disappear. All the children's dates of death on their gravestones is given as the 9th of January. We know that's not true, but it also ends up making it read like Brittany had made it to the age of 17, which she didn't.
She has a history of ignoring things. She didn't want to apply for the various benefits that she may or may not be entitled to. She didn't want to do stuff for the kids. She didn't clean up the house. She'd refused to let social workers in, and she expected the kids' bodies to just vanish, to just disappear.
Yeah.
She likes to stick her head in the sand. It's like if a light bulb goes off in a room, rather than change it, you just don't use the room.
Yes, that's exactly.
It's not a problem anymore. She's put the kids in a room. I keep referring to them as kids. I think that's me trying to humanize them.
Yes.
But when she put them in the room and shut the door, it was a bare, empty room. She's trying to shut that away from herself.
Yeah.
But then what is she doing in the meantime between when she murdered them to when she was uncovered?
I have exactly the same question. There's no electricity. There is no water. There's no furniture.
I'm surprised CPS haven't been called when you get the red flags of no electricity, no water, kids aren't in school. I feel like there should have been like an elevation. I understand sort of, depending on people's certain political views, whether or not how much government gets involved in people's lives. But when you have kids to look after and they're clearly in a bad environment, when should the government ever step in? The future generations of society getting messed up.
They are already involved with this family. This is why it was a huge, huge uproar. And they ended up with this investigation. Like I said, six got fired, but then three were allowed to have their jobs back. And I don't know the ins and outs. I couldn't even find that damn report, which annoyed the hell out of me as well, because there would have been a lot more information in that.
What does she think happened to Nathaniel? Because I know she said that he's going to come back at some point. That's why she didn't tell the kids to go to the funeral. So was that during her psychosis or afterwards? That I'm not quite sure of. Or is it kind of blended together?
It's all blended together. It seems to have gone on over nearly a year.
Is there any history, family history, if you can at all find it, of psychosis?
No.
Going back and looking at the family history is usually one of the first places to look at. I'm sure the PCP and weed probably helped their psychosis.
Yep.
Being sarcastic.
I think she also was mentally ill. I do think she was genuinely mentally ill, but I think it was probably the weed and the PCP that actually tipped her over into full-on mental illness of some description.
When some people try to experiment with certain drugs, you can have person A and person B and have completely different trips and then the subsequent effects from it afterwards. Some people can do things like ayahuasca, get absolutely stoned off their tits in a forest somewhere, and they come back out of it. They've had like an ego death. They can appreciate life in a different way. Certain things they were worried about, no problem anymore. No more anxiety. Other people come back, and because they've lost ego and sense of self, they kind of go a bit mental. And that's just biology. Some people do, some people don't. Some people just have a permanent change in their effects. Some people can take one drug and it does the job. Other people can take it and it has changes on an epigenetic level. It changes how their genes express themselves. She is one of them, where she took some PCP and weed with a history of potentially mental health issues. It's gone absolutely mental.
She seems to have been fine up until she meets Nathaniel.
But do we know if he's the catalyst?
I wonder, and I'll get into that in the
case. Or is he the person that's potentially introduced her to the drugs in the first place? We don't know if she did it before that.
No.
And it could have been that if she never took the drugs and she never would have had that happen.
Which I want to talk about in a case autopsy. And that is the end of this week's episode. And finally, the victims who should not be forgotten. Asia, aged 5. Nakaya, aged 6. Tatiana, aged 11. And Brittany, aged 16.
And that, everyone, is the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday Podcast. If you want more content, you can find the Patreon in the description below, all that good stuff. If you're on the Patreon, hang about. We're going to do the case autopsy. And again, thank you to Claire G and Sue. See you next time. Peace.
Bye.